Hello and welcome to what is now Season 5 of Pebble in the Pond podcast. My name is Sam Stewart and I am the CEO of the Australian and New Zealand Mental Health Association. Each year, ANZMHA hosts several leading mental health conferences which give us the opportunity to connect with incredible industry leaders, lived experience speakers, researchers, academics and frontline workers as they share fascinating stories and projects which are changing the face of mental health within our community. Listen in as we go one-on-one with these inspiring people and dive deep into their work. It is truly a privilege to bring you their stories. Our podcast episodes may contain content which could be triggering for some people. If you need support, please contact Lifeline on 131114 or visit the Get Help page on anzmh.asn.au. Join us for Pebble in the Pond each Tuesday and let's get into Season 5. Pip is an author, investigative journalist, radio presenter, podcast producer, host, and content architect of creative ideas all-rounder. After spending 18 years in the police force, Pip left the force in 2011 to raise her children and work on new projects. She has spent years in recovery from PTSD in which she continued her research in treatments for mental illness, advocacy for stigmas in society, and in particular a focus on the impact of insurance investigations on those with an invisible illness. With her trademark activism and calm enthusiasm, Pip strategically unpacks the themes, topics, and life-changing stories of women and men who are looking to share life lessons and empower others using the power of their own voice. On today's episode, Pip talks about overwhelm and overload, the mental health of victims of family and sexual violence, and how her own experiences helped to shape her work, her writing, and now her future. Welcome, Pip. Pip, thanks so much for joining me in the podcast. I was going to say the hot seat, but it's not so hot. I appreciate you coming along and thanks for sharing your story, your journey, and all the amazing things that you are up to and are doing at the moment in the space of mental health, but also your journey. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Listen, tell our listeners, give a bit of context so they understand your background and how you got into being a word styler.
Yeah, interesting story. And I have to probably go back to when I was in my teenage years, because part of my story started at a Rotary camp. So I got nominated as a sort of a natural born leader, went to one of those camps where you sort of interact, and I got the Yana Wendt Journalism Award.
Yeah, right.
And I was really passionate because I was outspoken. I was a talker. I was definitely a feminist at that stage as well.
Yes.
And I wanted to go into the arts and I wanted to go into media and all that stuff, but I didn't get in. So I went and joined the cops instead.
So this was when you're based in the Shire?
No, I was living out in the country.
Oh, wow.
So I come from a small country town called Burrawa.
Wow.
In central west New South Wales. About 1,000 people in town and we lived on a property out west.
Cool. So then you got to uni. Oh, no, you got to the police force.
Yeah, I went straight into the police force after school and stayed there for nearly 20 years.
Now, tell the listeners about what it was like to be in the police force and the role that you finished up at in the police force.
Yeah, I mean, I loved the job and I look back now and I have a lot of fond memories because I've got great friends from the force that I still speak to and I still support, especially when they're having a hard day. But I went in as a junior constable in the city, responding to all the stuff that you call the police out for, first responder on the scene always, chasing cars, breaking enters, robberies.
This is in Sydney, right?
And this is in Sydney back in the 90s. So from there, I went and did the Olympics, which I was really happy about. So I got into the dignitary and athlete protection. Yeah, that was brilliant. That was probably the best job ever. But at the same time, I'm also investigating sexual assaults and child protection issues and, you know, domestic violence.
What, just on the induction, well, even the time during the police, obviously things have changed a bit now, but
I hope so.
Was well-being, was it discussed, was mental health discussed or PTSD or any awareness around what you possibly face as a police officer?
No, and I think that even if you tried to tell me at 19, I wouldn't have the reference points. Even though my dad was in the police and my mum was an emergency nurse, I think because of their coping strategies, that felt comfortable for me. So I've always felt comfortable in the chaos, which was interesting. So when I went into the police, it sort of felt normal and I actually quite enjoyed it. And you were solving problems and you were helping people and that was sort of the purpose behind joining. I mind you, I did sort of join with the purpose of going for 5 years and ended up staying for 18. Wow. So that sort of shows you that there is a real family there, that you can find real purpose for work and friends.
What's one of the most challenging part of being a police officer is relating to, you know, continually looking after your well-being?
What I'm going to be talking about today, overload. Yeah.
Perfect.
Just the overwhelming amount of work that you have to absorb and then synthesize in that sort of split second. And I think that that's one of the skills I didn't realize that I had until I left, as to how much information I can take in and make really quick decisions on in order to respond, so to reduce the harm. So it's challenging work, and I don't think everybody's cut out for it. And a lot of my friends have said to me, there's no way I could do that job.
Is that something that's trained, or is it something that you have?
No, it's definitely a training tool. And I can look back now, and because I'm also still involved with the police, I can see how they do mold you and they train you and they build up your resilience and for you to be able to cope with those sort of levels of stress.
Wow. Okay. So, and then with the Sydney Olympics, you obviously love that role.
Mm.
Then what was the catalyst? What was the reason that you got out of the police?
Yeah. So I then went into alcohol related crime. So I did a lot of the legislation around lockout laws and, you know, the licensing of premises and all of that sort of thing as well. And then domestic violence. And I think at that stage I had, you know, 4 children. I'd sort of done my time and I was sort of feeling not like myself. Like I sort of look in the mirror and I wouldn't recognize myself. I was behaving in ways that I was angry was a big symptom for me. I was always angry and I didn't like myself being like that.
Just your default was angry.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And non-compliance triggered that anger. So I sort of recognized that I started to treat my children like criminals because they wouldn't comply with that. And then when I went and did the positive parenting course, it literally opened my eyes up and changed my whole, and I had to unlearn everything that I'd learned from the police about trying to, because it's coercive control that police use to get people to do what they need them to do to stay safe, but also to uphold the law as well.
Tell us about the positive parenting experience. How did that impact the way you parented and also the impact to your kids?
And that's probably where I became the word styler, because I ended up using language. So police traditionally use about 3 words per sentence. It's very short, sharp sentences. So it's move over here.
Right.
Get out of the car. Like, we don't speak in full sentences because of the time frame that we're dealing with situations. So we just want people to do things. I spoke to my kids like that. So you can imagine how spiky that must feel for them. So when I started explaining to them, listen, this is not appropriate, or we don't do things like that, their response was immediate. So 2 of my children had symptoms of secondary post-traumatic stress. And I was told—
Did they really?
Yeah. And so I was told by their psychologist, it's not them with the problem, it's you.
You wouldn't have been the only person that was going home talking to your kids like this though either.
I'm pretty sure it's across the board, yeah. And the police that I've spoken to now and the police that I support who, you know, ring me up and they'll go, I'm thinking about leaving. They see what I'm doing and they go, how do I have what you're having sort of thing. And I just say, oh, listen, you just need to, you know, look after yourself, focus on your kids and sort of really do the inner work.
What about the stigma, you know, the role that played in the force? I mean, this is different times now, obviously, but back then it would have been something that you spoke too often about to your police officers, to your fellow officers, like you wouldn't be talking about this stuff regularly.
No, and I think that you've got to really protect. There's a real reputation that you have to protect in the police so that people rely, because you're relying on those people that you work with for life and death decisions.
Yes.
So if you're giving off a vibe that you're not coping, that you're not going to back people up, that sort of, that's that energy of that sort of flows between you that you go, actually, I don't feel safe, because a lot of your safety relies on that trust bond. And in 12 hours, you can really build that quite deeply, probably more so than any other friendship that you've ever had. But you know that then you can rely on them as well. So
was it something that an exercise, an outlet for you?
Yeah. So that balance.
Yeah.
It was definitely the balance. And because we were working 2 days on, 2 days, 2 night shifts and 6 off, we had a lot of spare time.
Right.
And I needed to stay busy. Like I just needed something else to do.
Yes. I just think that overarching holistic wellness approach, I just think is really important these days.
Yeah. And I think that probably helped me maintain my mental health in the police for a very long time, until you have children and you can't move as much. But yeah, I think moving, health and fitness, I do a lot of meditation. But, you know, some of my injuries, I guess, that I had, not only just the PTS, I call it PTS now because it's post-traumatic stress. It's not a disorder. It's very much an injury that you get from your workplace. I also had adrenal burnout. So like a fatigue.
Because you're always on?
You're always on. The hypervigilance is there. Yeah, and your cortisol levels are up. So I would, and also doing night shift, your body's out of clock. So it's not a healthy way to exist. And I was still doing that when I had children as well.
So what was the point at which you thought something's not right here? Obviously, you said you were angry all the time, but was it something that someone else pointed out, or was it a reflection that you had, was there a point at which you thought, you know what, this isn't quite right. Things aren't right.
Yeah. And I think, and interestingly, I was always on that positive side. Like my glass was always refillable. You know, I always had half full. It was always going to get better. And in 2005, I actually applied to the New South Wales Health for a $500 gift, like a grant for the police to do a mental health program. At the time, it wasn't supported by my commander. It was like, that's something you have to do on your own. And we won it. So we actually had somebody come in and talk to us about mental health. At the same time, they were giving them a half hour shoulder massage as well, and just teaching them what that base stress line should look like, rather than operating up here at this high level all the time.
And was that the start of something?
Yeah, every year from that, I did a mental health day, which was the 10th of October.
Yeah.
And interestingly, the last day of my service was the 10th of October.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Coincidentally.
Coincidentally, but I think there was something related to it because it was obviously something inside me that was just going, it's too much.
So after the forced, what happened then?
I took a career break, as it reflects on my resume.
Yes.
And it was much needed. It was the recovery phase. So I did prescribed treatments for PTSI, and then I did meditation and went into it and just found a network of amazing professionals that supported me. And I guess because I started to change, my relationship started to change as well. So my children became much more much closer to me, and I was much more attentive to them, but I also had time and space to do that. And my ex-husband and I started to drift.
Wow.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, I think you put in all the coping strategies to keep the status quo, when really what it did was it forced me off the edge and to crack it open and shake it up and let it fall where it came.
And so what was that? Did you have much support going through that stage of your life? Was there family around? I mean, because it would have been quite a challenging time for you to go through that process, but also, you know, as well, with your relationship, did you have a good solid support network?
Yeah, I was pretty lucky. I didn't hear much from police. I think that they had that stigma that you're a bit crazy.
Yeah, right.
Which you're not. You're just in overwhelm all the time. But I still had some good friends out of that. You know, 18 years is a long time, and some of them I've known since I was at the academy. But I guess, you know, I was lucky. I had two really good friends, Angela and Leah, who I had met during the PTSD courses. And the treatments that we were getting, and that was really eye-opening, and I would highly recommend that to anybody with any sort of trauma. But this one was actually a specific police trauma course, which Dr. Selwyn Smith had created back in the 80s for police, because he could see the trend that was uptaking in mental health and attributing to the suicides that they were reporting. And then I had, you know, I had my family, my mom and my sister were always on board. They helped out with the kids, but I also engaged things like nannies to help me during the day so that I could get some downtime. Having kids sort of keeps you up as well.
Yes, know the feeling.
So it's not like, you've got to find what works for you. And I found that I went to my counselor, I regularly took my medication, and that all sort of evened me out. And I was able to sort of get to a point where I went, okay, what is it that I need to do? But that was a long time.
Yes.
That was a very long time.
And so then how was the transition then? I mean, because you've been very inspirational and an advocate for victims of domestic family violence and sexual violence. What inspired you to go into that, down that path and be an advocate for that and a bit of a change maker?
I think I saw the gap, to be honest, because in the system that we had, and I was coming from a space where I dealt with offenders, I investigated, I knew why they were doing things. And then I sort of went to the other side and went, okay, so you're supporting her, but no one's actually talking about this bit in the middle and strategizing for them as to what their best interests are or what would keep them safe. Police are very much focused on the offence that the offender has created and how they can stop that from happening again, whereas DV workers are very much about keeping women safe, yes, women and children safe. Their focus is, it's not about the process of going through court and holding them accountable. It's very different work. So that needed to come together, because then you have your conflict where, you know, you might not have enough evidence for a successful prosecution. So therefore, the victim or the advocate gets told, we don't have enough. And that's devastating, because everybody sort of thinks that the police are the answer, but they're not. They're just part of the process.
Yeah.
And we need to work together as a community. And the impact that I saw on women's mental health, I've experienced it. I think, you know, I see the coercive control in my ex-husbands, the misogyny, the attitudes, their behaviours, and having all that experience, I think also helped me have very high thresholds and tolerance as well. So
yes,
I was always comparing myself, going, mine's not as bad, but it should never be this hard.
So for about 25 years or so now, you've been in that space and being very proactive. How have you seen the changes in systems, in processes that benefits victims? You know, do you think we're moving in the right direction? And do you think it's very, because every state, everything seems to be so different from where you are, where you're living. Do you find that we're sort of heading in the right direction with where our services are going to better support victim survivors?
Yeah, we're definitely heading towards victim-centric, which I think is really important, and holding perpetrators accountable. We're definitely now, I've been to a couple of conferences lately, and we're definitely moving towards the looking at the history of relationships and that predominant aggressor rather than the primary aggressor for a particular incident, which is really disheartening, because if you've got women fighting back or surviving or trying to escape, then that can be seen as an act of resistance, which actually puts them in the hot seat. So we've got a lot of misidentified offenders out there, and I've seen men as well as victims. So that's why it's not a gendered debate about what happens to men and women. It's just that their experiences are different. Yes. Women's are much more sexualized. They're much more vulnerable because of their economic situation or the caring role that they have for children, and that adds complex layers, whereas men traditionally don't have those issues. Men are more scared about other men than women, whereas right, women are fearful that men will kill them.
And they have done.
They continue to do, and I think the media keeps telling us that women are unsafe because there's nowhere in the world that they can be and feel safe, which is really heartbreaking.
Do you think that's really a big cause of the culture of that with women and their safety in feeling safe? Do you think the media and the way that's portrayed, the messaging?
Yeah, I think they, you know, you wouldn't look at me and go, you're a victim of domestic violence, but I am. Yeah. But it's not the violence that you think of. And when we talk about violence, it's very much encapsulated into a number of behaviours. And I'm sure my ex-husband would say the same thing.
Yeah.
Because that is conflict within a relationship, but it's when it starts to escalate and there is power over or control over somebody else, whether it's being held to a, you know, a promise or being threatened with images that they might share or, you know, monitored all the time and stalked. They're the sort of things that we look at as serious.
Well, let's talk about did you establish a Women's Change Behaviour Program, and tell us about that and what it does.
Yeah, so the Gift of Safety is a women's change behaviour program, and it's a number of practitioners, including life coaches and yoga teachers and people who are all about well-being and empowering women to make the change. I don't think we can ask the men of those perpetrators to change. I don't think they do. They'll change when they're ready. So what we need to do is help women see that they can change, and that will ultimately impact on the change towards their partner. But it really is about taking back the choice. And I've done that myself. So I went to New York for a month. I lived there and came back and asked for a divorce.
Did you really? Is that how it worked?
Yeah.
So where were you? Midtown?
I was upper west side. Yeah, cool. On Columbus. And I had a little apartment there. I had my three children with me and we stayed there for a month. He was invited. I thought it was going to be a family holiday, but he didn't want to come, so I took the kids and I just every day just worked on something that was, you know, not feeling right, like just did natural stuff, lots of walking,
yep,
played with the kids, you know.
Yes.
Real focus on them.
Quality time.
came back and I think I was home 3 days and I went, oh my God, it's not me.
Yeah, this isn't
what... I'm actually okay.
Is this why you titled your book My New Way?
It's My New York Way with the York crossed out.
I didn't know whether to say the York or not. So tell us about the book and the inspiration behind it.
So it's a lot of the story. So the 30 days that I was over there and just taking responsibility for, you know, like journaling a lot. I think journaling is probably the most powerful thing that victims of domestic violence or even people who aren't happy can do, because you look back and you can, it's like if it's really authentic, you know that it's not going to go anywhere. You can be real with yourself and go through all the emotions and record them all. And I guess what I worked out was that I had these 31 days to myself where I could create a whole new person. I was in another country halfway around the world and I could do and be whatever I wanted because there was nobody there that knew me.
Yeah, you knew no one.
It was like a clean slate. I knew when I'd come back though that there would be resistance and challenge because I became who I wanted to be over there. The parent I wanted to be, the person I wanted to be.
Yes. Do you think it was because you were removed out of your comfort zone around your day to day, so all of a sudden you had a fresh lens and time to really reflect?
Time and space I had, and I just had that ability to go, well, who do I want to be today? And so I practiced that. And who do I want to be the next day? And practice that. And I don't think you can do that in, I find it very difficult to do it in the real world.
Yeah.
Because you've got so many competing challenges. And it really worked for me. And I think that's the thing, is that you've got to find what works.
That's awesome. And so how old are your kids when you went over?
16, 8. We actually timed it so that my youngest one turned 8 and we went up to the Empire State Building for his birthday.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it was about, you know, creating those really good memories because, you know, I've bashed myself up enough about being a parent, bad parent.
Yes.
And I've really wanted to, you know, be there and be present with them.
But as a parent, we do that a lot. Like we bash ourselves up. You feel stress, pressure, you take it out, or you say something you don't mean, or and your kids feel that. And so it's not till you sit back and reflect on it that you start thinking, you know what, God, I need to do something. That wasn't right. I'm not setting the example. I'm not being the person that I want to be. And I feel like to an extent we all have that, don't we?
Yeah.
And so is this book basically a structure, a format, a process that you can undertake to find yourself again, but actually be the person you want to be?
Yeah, it's reset. More about, because I had massive identity crisis once I left the police. I didn't know who I was without a badge.
Yes.
I think most police will tell you that as well. And becoming who you want to be when you don't know what that looks like is really difficult when you're doing it on your own. So I was lucky. I actually got a coach about 3 months before, and she was the one that planted the seed, Angela. Planted the seed and said, what do you want to do? What would you do if nothing was off the table? And I went, I'd go and live in New York for a month. And she said, why can't you do that? And I said, I can. She goes, well, do it. And I just set it up in motion. So it was about that projection, planning, and then working every day towards who you wanted to be. And it's a transformation. It was like.
Yes. That's awesome.
Yeah. It was really, and I think. For me, especially where I was, when you've got PTSI, it's very much around the surroundings, remind you of so much trauma. So my house was traumatic, my suburbs were, my friends, because they knew or they, you know, I'd spoken to them about it before. And when you're not talking about it anymore and when you're able to just fill your life with other stuff.
So did you come back and change a lot of that stuff?
Yeah, like I painted walls and moved furniture.
Did you move suburbs and...
No, we stayed in the house. Okay. Yeah, and you know, there was issues around that because you're financially tied together. So it's not like
easy as it.
It's not as easy as people think. And I think that's the challenge, is that you've got an idea of who you want to be and what you want to do.
Yes.
And they still think that you're the same person. So it's taken a while for him to get to the point where, you know, okay, that's who she is now. It's not the person that I married. She's somebody completely different. He's the same. And it needs to be like that. Like, you just need time. And I think we don't give ourselves that.
Did the time and space give you the strength?
Yeah. And the confidence.
Yeah.
Because once I started doing, I was being. And then I was being her. And so I started doing what she wanted to do. And I talk about her in a third person because she's not me today. Like, it's a completely different person that started that journey. And then it's basically like she's handed over the baton. And, you know, and I went into radio. So I came back and I went into radio and created an online presence and started doing the advocacy work. And to be honest, I really didn't know what advocacy did. Like,
yes,
but I'd been doing it for 30 years.
Yeah, you're doing it. I was doing it anyway,
naturally, yeah.
That's really interesting. I mean, I love that. I love the process you went through and the transformation that occurred as a result of that and the courage it gave you to come back and believe in the new path that you wanted to take. I mean, it's inspiring to listen to. Let's talk about the online side of things. So let's talk about that firstly as it relates to identities and reality and the way things are going. Are you fearful with where things are going as it relates to what the new norm is with relationships, connections with the online world versus the reality and the way things used to be? Deep question, but I just want to get your thoughts.
And I guess scared is probably not the right word I would use. I would describe it as discombobulating.
Oh, good word.
Because what you don't know how to handle and deal with. But in my space, I've been doing that for 30 years. I was walking into jobs and having 100 outcomes already in my head. So I'm used to that. So I'm not scared of that. What I am is I'm fearful of the impact that it's going to have on our children if we don't give them the right messages and if we don't teach them about these new tools. It's like when, you know, cars got invented. We sort of had to learn the road rules. Mm-hmm. You have to, you know, understand the safety mechanisms and all that sort of stuff. And there's a big fear around that when you don't know it. And that's why we've got this massive generation gap. We've got my mum, who's nearly 80, trying to communicate with a 13-year-old, and they're talking different languages.
Yeah, and they find it easier to text or to message you.
Whereas my mum would find that really rude. She goes, why can't you pick up the phone?
Yes. It's interesting, isn't it? Because you just wonder what the connections and relationships will be like moving forward. Mm-hmm. Where are they as authentic? Are they the way we talk to each other so different online versus in the real world, especially when you hear this stuff around the metaverse and where that stuff is heading? It feels like people will be more inclined to spend more time in the virtual reality than the real reality that we call real right now. And you just think it's a shame. You just don't want to go too far.
Well, and you got to think, like, what's the purpose of doing it online? There's a lot of control online. You can opt out, for one. You can be who you want to be.
You can also be someone else.
You can also be someone else. Celeste Hadley has a great podcast or an interview about reality versus online. And I think that sort of what she says really sums up how, you know, when we lose that art of conversation, when we're not able to talk to each other, we're not able to solve problems, because sending an email to someone is literally saying, this is what I want you to know. Sending a text is like, this is the basic information, give me a response. Whereas a phone call is where you have to interact and you problem solve. And I think that that's the difference between doing that face-to-face connection and having conversations around, you know, paper trails or that sort of thing. So, yeah, I think we need to understand what communication looks like for the future, but not get too hung up on, you know, the kids, unfortunately, you know, if you leave them on read, they get a bit distressed.
Yes, yes. You know, and this is a thing as a parent, like you gotta almost, because it's not going to go away. So you got to figure out how to coexist with the new way of doing things, but also get a bit of old school methods intertwined in there somehow and keep them grounded and actually have real conversations.
Yeah. And you want to teach them how to do that either, because you know, they're not going to be in the virtual world for their whole working life. They're going to have to deal with people and have relationships.
I just want to go back to, so we spoke about perpetrators before. As a psychology of perpetrators, are there patterns that we see with the victims that they go after? Do you find that there's certain things that they look for? And is this what the Women's Behavioral Change Program is really trying to identify and really try and help change so that they don't become an easy target for perpetrators?
Yeah, and I think that's got a lot to do with social norms. So women have traditionally been brought up to be people pleasers and, you know, and make sure that everything's running smoothly and look the part or make them look good. And that's being challenged, especially in the last 20 years, just with equality. Like, we're not taking up any more space. We're just vying for the equity that men already have. And it's that vulnerability. I also know that, you know, men have the secret handshake. They have a natural alliance, and it's only recently that women have worked out that we can have our own. You know, we can protect other women, but we never wanted to if something was going on between a man and woman, we never wanted to intervene because, oh, we don't want him to look bad or feel bad, but we don't want her to get hurt either. So everyone has sort of shunned that and gone, oh, I don't know what to do. But if you learn and you know how to address it, and even saying some things as simple as, it's really inappropriate, ones that I use in one of my comedy skits that I, with my sister, you know, I go, you know, that's so 1985. Like, we don't talk like that anymore. Because quite often the kids, like my kids, will tell me that, Mum, you can't say that anymore. It's 2023.
Yeah, yeah.
So I reverse it and it just sort of breaks the ice a little bit, but it also just puts that boundary up that somebody's looking after her. And I've had a number of interventions. I've had to do a number of interventions. I can't help myself on occasions because it's not a police thing. It's just a, you know, I can see it. I can sense it and I can feel it and hear it going on.
I feel like we're in a place now where it feels like it's safer to call this stuff out. I feel like it's more appropriate, but it's also more education, more awareness is out there now. And for the culture to change, because it's been the culture, right? That's how parents were brought up. And this is the way it was always, it was just a part of being a bloke or being a woman.
Yes.
The way that they were treating each other and the interactions. So I feel like now's a more than ever has been a good time to be able to call this stuff out and say, well, hang on, that's not really that appropriate. And I'm sorry, you can't really say that sort of stuff now. Is that the sort of thing that you're feeling?
Yeah. And I think it's definitely happening, but I can tell you there is still a lot of attitudes at my age bracket, that 45 to upwards, where they will dismiss it as, you know, when men are sort of bashing on their wives or, you know, saying something inappropriate, they won't call it out amongst themselves.
No.
I've seen a few good men stand up and do it. But again, I don't think men know what to say.
Yes.
They don't have the language, the words, they don't know how to articulate it so that they don't put themselves at risk. Because the tradition is that if you intervene, he'll take on you and you'll become the target.
Yes.
And that's what men are scared of.
Is it that masculinity? That's what it's about, isn't it?
Yeah, and a sense of entitlement. It's rooted in entitlement. And I think when we perceive respect or disrespect as shifting, then that's when the tables turn because we get upset about that.
Yeah.
When really, it's got nothing to do with us. Actually, that's their behaviour and that's what they're dealing with. And they've probably got a whole heap more going on than we know about.
If we look to the future of where things are heading, what gives you excitement? What do you think are the most encouraging things to look at as it relates to family violence, stress, all these factors that you've been associated with and really being played a big role in lately, the overload that you spoke about earlier? Where do you think things are at and where do you think things are heading?
I think we've now given ourselves permission to rest.
Yeah.
I think COVID did a wonderful thing for that. I certainly embraced it because I suddenly felt like I didn't have to justify my existence. And I certainly didn't explain or defend myself to anyone. Like I just sort of went, okay, this is what we have to do. And I've sort of carried that through probably now, but I still struggle with showing that overload and asking for help. And that's something that I'll probably have to continue to work on because I've been so capable most of my life. So that's quite, I think most people will still find that challenging. But I think the fact that we've got DV leave at work, you know, we can take time off because it does take over 2 weeks to get appointments, to get new housing, to make sure that the kids are safe and settled. And it takes that amount of time to actually unpack what's happened to them as well, especially if it's a crisis. But you also need the time to move on as well. And that support and ongoing recovery for as long as it takes. And we can't put numbers on that. Like you can't say you can only have 10 sessions. That puts a blanket, you know, across everyone and doesn't take into account the individual need and the complexities of it. But women's safety will continue to expand. And I think men's safety has to as well. And unfortunately, I did a couple of years in the men's space and suicide is rife. And you can see it happening. And when you see men that are ticking all the boxes, my heart goes out to them because they've lost their identity and they don't know who they are anymore and they don't know who they want to be.
That identity is a big thing, isn't it? A big thing for adults, male, female, even for kids, working out their place in the world and what their identity is. There's so much going on. Where do you fit in the world? What's your role?
Yeah, I think you've got to fit in now. Like, you know, it's like I've come up from Sydney today and I'm like, okay, I'm here on the Gold Coast today and I'm being present and I've got things that I need to do But I've also got my long-term stuff happening. And, and I think the anxiety and the depression stops that. It puts up walls on either side of today because the stuff that happened yesterday or the stuff that might happen tomorrow actually consumes us in the moment.
How is your mental health? Are you good?
I'm awesome, to be honest. Yeah, I've never felt more like myself. I really like this version.
Yeah.
I sort of get a bit of a pinch me moment when I start doing and start being. And I'm really lucky. I've got great friends and who bolster up my self-esteem. And I literally had a call with, my colleague Maria this morning and said, just tell me why I'm doing this again. Like, why am I up at 4:30 in the morning? And but I think, that's what you need. You need those strategies, those people and what works for you. So yeah, I just really protect my time and energy now. And I invest in the people that I like and pursue, and everything else is a no. So it's really handy tips for me to work.
There is an art to saying no, isn't there?
Not right now. Can I get back
to that? Okay. I want to get your thoughts on, so just quickly, we're almost rounding for home, but just your organization, the role that organizations are playing now in the DV space, but also the mental health, depression, anxiety, creating safe spaces for people to work in. Tell us about how you're seeing that and where you think that's going to head in the future as well.
Yeah, and it's fantastic. Like I'm seeing organizations all the time creating that space for people to, to express how they feel, but not hold it against them. Like, and I think I was telling you about it before, when you're in the police, if you lose that sort of trust with somebody or that belief, that can literally derail your whole career. So I think that people are being a lot more compassionate. They're understanding that life events happen and you've got to find some way to support. And when you go, you need to find the support, people go, what does that look like? It might be somebody talking to you. It might be a walk. It might be going out for dinner with friends. Like there's a whole heap of things that can be done to actually hold somebody and hold the space for them while they just regulate their emotions. And I think you've also got to take ownership for that of yourself as well. Like I'm very much a believer that these are my feelings and I don't know what you're thinking. But, if I get offended by the way you're speaking to me, what's that mean for me?
And how to safely be able to communicate that as well.
Yeah. And I think that is, I've worked really hard with my language to change it, to unlearn the police language and to find a way to express myself. It was like the words literally fell out of my mouth or was, literally an intravenous drip from my hand when I'm writing. And I probably did get told in the police that I was too emotional. Or too descriptive in my fact sheet.
Right.
Because I wanted to capture the impact. I think that's a thing, I think that people need to, they hang off your words when you're listening.
Did you ever think one day you'd be an author?
Yes.
You did?
Yeah. Yeah, I've manifested that one.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Like the journey you've been on, it's just amazing, isn't it? When you look back at your journey to where you are now, it just seems...
Yeah.
So different. I
didn't think it would be this outcome. I've had a lot of mentors. I've met some really good people who have given me access to other people who have then given me the light bulb moments.
Ideas, inspiration.
I never knew I could do that. Yeah. Is that a thing? And I love that when I can do that for other people and they go, I didn't know that was a thing. Yes, it's a thing. You can do that. You can make choices.
That's great, isn't it? I love that. I think it's been really good having a chat. Tell us about where can people get the book and where can people get in touch with you?
So it's pipbray.com.
Yep.
And it's all over. You pretty much just have to Google that now, as my children quite regularly do, and you'll find all the links on the page.
What exciting projects do you have coming up?
We've got a really good mental health project coming up called Waterfall.
Oh, wow.
Which is really exciting. So I've got a great mentor in Tracy Smith from Waterfall Group, and I'm doing some work with her around how we can get, because at the moment there's a long wait for mental health.
Yes.
And so we're trying to access, that support for people much, much earlier, within days rather than months. And having those children, having my children experience psychologists, that waiting around and how anxious they are and the impact afterwards, there just needs to be more.
Listen, it's been really insightful. Pip, as expected, you've carried the whole conversation. So I appreciate your time. Thanks so much for your story. It's been really fascinating getting your background, understanding the context, but really you can see the transformation when you hear about it. I mean, it all makes sense. And to see you here today explaining the journey you've been on and the transformations you've undertaken, the passion that you speak from in what you're doing at the moment, I mean, it's just so clear and obvious. So congratulations for being, not only doing it for yourself, but being an inspiration for others to pursue their own inspiration and their own transformations as well.
Thanks. Well, I'll put it down to good questions, but you're probably the first one to get that full story.
Well, thanks for your time, Pip. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode. Feel free to share with your friends and colleagues. And if you know someone working in mental health that you'd like to see featured on the podcast, please email any suggestions to us at membership@anzmh.asn.au. You can also stay up to date on our socials at ANZMHA on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Thank you so much for listening, and we look forward to sharing our next episode with you next week.